We are back for another edition of the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and I'm excited to welcome you to this podcast that brings you in-depth conversations with Hall of Famers and tennis legends that go beyond their on-court results. Each year, the International Tennis Hall of Fame celebrates the sport's greatest players and contributors by presentation of tennis's ultimate honor, enshrinement, into the Hall of Fame. This exclusive recognition represents the sum of a person's career as being truly at the top of the sport, the best of the best. As we are dedicated to preserving tennis's history and celebrating those incredible champions, we frequently ponder the question, what makes a Hall of Famer? What is that unique something that led to their historic success? Was it innate, or did they need to cultivate a winning mindset over time? Answering these questions and more is what the Tennis Worthy Podcast aims to do. Chris Bowers, an esteemed tennis journalist of more than three decades and a biographer of Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, will be chatting with our legendary guests here on Tennis Worthy. Today, Chris will be chatting with Hall of Famer Tracy Austin.
I was always thinking, how can I maximize? Where can I get better? Think about it. Put yourself in that same situation. You're all in the same boat, but this one player gets that extra attention. That will light the fire in your belly. Guy hit me at 65 miles an hour in my front left wheel well, so half a second more, he would have hit my door and I wouldn't be here. And I think that changed my perspective. That one shot, I think, set me apart in that match. I feel very appreciative that I had the career. You know, when I was seven, did I think I was going to do all that? I don't think so.
Tracy's meteoric rise in women's tennis was so startling and attention-grabbing that when, as a 14-year-old, she lost in the quarterfinals of the 1977 U.S. Open, her post-match cool-down included a supportive call from then-President Jimmy Carter. At 16 years, 8 months, and 28 days, Tracy became the youngest male or female champion in U.S. Open history, a distinction that still remains today. You'll hear from Tracy that her story starts even earlier than that, and it was her deep immersion in the sport from that very young age that helped her focus on the little details to which she attributes her giant success. I'll leave you now with Chris Bowers and Tracy Austin. Chris, take it away.
Tracy Austin, what do you think it is that makes you a Hall of Famer?
That's such an interesting question. There's so many facets of the game of tennis that you really have to succeed at, particularly in an individual sport, because I feel like you can have more deficits, more weaknesses, possibly, that other teammates in basketball, football can make up for. But I think it's the little details. It's the things that you are growing up with, learning how to cope with stress, learning how to cope with adversity during matches. It could be adversity with injuries, learning how to set goals, because so often kids just don't have a clear focus of what they want to achieve. I grew up at the Jack Kramer Tennis Club, which Jack Kramer, former world champion, started with Vic Braden. So because Jack was always around, he brought the likes of Rod Laver and Roy Emerson, Ken Rosewall, many champions through the club when they were in Los Angeles at that time to play the Pacific Southwest, which was a tournament at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. But they would stay for weeks on end sometimes because the weather was great, great practice courts. I think those kind of people, to watch them play, to hear stories about them, that was very inspiring. So then your mind starts to dream. You start to dream, because I love tennis right from the beginning. My mom was actually the manager of the Jack Kramer Tennis Club. So she was there 6 days a week. I was the youngest of five. So therefore, I was there 6 days a week from 9 to 6. Very lucky. I feel like it was a perfect storm that I love tennis, and I got to be around it all day, every day, with a plethora of people to practice with, whether it was adults there, women, men, kids, boys, girls, whatever it was, great coaches. So because of that opportunity that I had and the passion that I clearly had right from the start for tennis, it was a perfect setting for success. That's just the foundation. But then we can go more into the mindset, the character traits, the discipline, all of those things that you need to become a champion.
I mean, you obviously had a great immersion in tennis, but what did you pick up from Emerson, Laver, Rose Wall, and Jack Cramer himself that maybe others who had the same immersion didn't pick up?
We're talking down to the smallest minutia, because the club that I grew up at, Vic Braden was the pro there, and he made tennis fun. He came at the perfect time when I was starting tennis. I loved it. He started us with balloons. We were playing, having relay races. We were playing games all the time. Gosh, this is fun. I'm always laughing. I want to play more tennis. 7 years old, Vic decided to move down south in Southern California and start his own tennis center. So a taskmaster came to the club named Robert Lansdorp, probably just around the right time. When he came in, I was developing my strokes, and he was very particular about stroke production and went over and over and over until you got it right, or until he thought it was the right particular stroke. He wanted it perfect because he thought it was a really clean technique, then it would be repeatable under pressure. And I liked that kind of discipline. That really worked well with my kind of personality. I was challenged by that, to do something over and over and try to get better, try to hit it closer to the lines. He had targets that he set out. I wanted to beat everybody else with how many out of 10, how many out of 20. So that kind of personality for a coach was right in my wheelhouse. For other kids, they didn't really love it. But that's where I started to develop the discipline, where you practice hard and the next day you get up and do it again. You play tournaments on the weekends, you win it, maybe have a loss. And then I actually enjoyed trying to figure out, problem solve of, okay, why did I lose? What can I improve? Next week, I'm going to work on X, Y, Z because I want to beat that person next time. And they picked out a weakness. So I found all of that very challenging, intriguing. I enjoyed the challenge of trying to improve. I think a lot of kids, I would look around and they would get, you know, down about a loss, or they felt that it was too much. It was overwhelming. And I think because I had such a great passion for the dynamics, the tactics of tennis, I really wanted to dig into it deeper. And my mom loved that. And I think she was really the one, Robert gets so much credit for my career, but my mom really was more of the tactician, because after I played a match, we kind of break it down, and she was the one that saw the court more, you know, hit it here and hit it here and then hit it short over here, or how to play, how to react to certain dynamics in a match. So she was a real strategist, and that, again, that intrigued me. There's so many things that have to go into it. I'm just digging into looking back at a kid that just wanted to do more, to push myself more. At the end of the day, we practiced 3 hours a day, and I was still there because my mom was working. So I would go down on the backboard.
How old were you hitting 3 hours a day?
10, 11. But they would be gone because they didn't have to stay at the club. But I had no choice because my mom had to work till 6. If they're gone, I'd go down to the backboard and make up imaginary matches against people. I'd get a bucket of balls and go hit some serves. I'd grab somebody and say, hey, let's just hit for a little bit. Everybody else was gone. So I got that extra bit of practice. And I think if you start to think about that, multiply it by number of days in the week, number of weeks in the month, and on and on and on, that extra practice gave me the belief, and it all builds on top of each other.
And is that just circumstances, or is it determination?
It's both. It's both. It was, like I call it, the perfect storm, to have Vic, to have Robert, to have the Cramer Club with lots of people to practice with, the weather that we had, but also this burning desire, this burning drive to get better. Because I could have been there going to the playground. I could have gone to the swing set, and my mom was working, so she wasn't saying, go do this, go do that. I had this extra time, and I was always thinking, how can I maximize? Where can I get better? Can I go jump rope? Can I go practice my serve? Whatever it was. And that's because that fire in the belly that was there. And I think it's, you know, you look at champions, they just want to keep driving themselves. The drive is pretty clear.
And that fire was from you. It wasn't from anyone else.
It wasn't. I tell the story that my mom of five, and my dad was a nuclear physicist. So he was working most of the time. He was a scientist. He wanted us to be scientists. Unlucky for him, he got tennis players. But so because she's working so much, she would buy me a little Hallmark calendar. It was 3 inches by 3 inches. And it was up to me, starting at 9 years old, to make my matches for the week. So I'd get on the phone and say, you know, Mrs. Goyette, Mr. Shoemaker, Dr. Eichel, can you play Wednesday night at 5? Can you play Saturday morning at 9? that gave me a big sense of responsibility. She didn't have time to do that for five kids. And I think that you dictating your life and you deciding where you're going to go and how much you practice really gave me a sense of self-belief at a young age. It was up to me. If I wanted it, I was going to have to do a lot of the legwork.
So you're phoning club members who are, what, 30, 40 years older than you and saying, hi, will you hit with me?
Well, and juniors as well. So I had certain people, Anna Marie on Tuesday. It was Liz on Wednesday, Trey on Thursday, Anne Lucie on Friday. Those were the set juniors that I played with. They were all nationally ranked. We were all pushing each other. And if I saw them practicing a bit harder, then I pushed myself to practice more. There was always a little bit of underlying competition. You have to be competitive. But, you know, I think that the fact that my mother didn't have time to do everything, you know, they talk about Uncle Tony making Rafa clean the lines and brush the court after he's done and pick up the balls. And all of that, I think, is important because it all builds up to that self-belief that you can do it on your own. And that trickles over into a match. I can figure this out. I'm down 4-2. Okay, what are his weaknesses? What are her weaknesses? You know, how can I change this around? And instead, there's so many players that play the same way against player A, player B, first set, second set. And that's where the details really need to come into play.
And this is all on hard courts?
All on hard courts. We don't have anything else in Southern California. We have a couple of clay courts, if you can find them. But otherwise, it's hard courts.
And was there any fitness regime at that time to try and make sure that you protected your body? Because, I mean, your body's growing at that age.
Yeah, no, not at that time. I mean, it's very different today. Now, the fitness regime, I might jump rope, but that was just something that I did as a little girl. But when I was probably 15, so we're talking a different number of years, I started doing more weights because I'd come on the tour. I was 5 foot tall, you know, 90 pounds, and I'm playing against Martina. Clearly, there was a need to become stronger. Obviously, the growth was going to come when it came, but I was going to have to try to maximize to get as stronger as quickly as possible.
What was the boost that you referred to a few minutes ago?
The boost that I haven't talked about is there was a certain player that our coach, and I'm not going to go into names, but seemed to favor, and he would give, I would assume, free lessons to her. And so my other friends that were in the same situation where, you know, we were middle class, we couldn't afford all sorts of lessons for me and the other four siblings. So I was, until I was about 14, I was getting a half an hour of tennis lessons a week, which is a very small, not very minimal. And this other player would be getting 2 hours a day or an hour a day. And that would drive us, I think, to work harder. And, you know, we're going to show him that we, you know, we don't need as much or we can do this. You know, think about it. Put yourself in that same situation. You're all in the same boat, but this one player gets that extra attention. That will light the fire in your belly. I mean, and there's more detail. The more detail is I played that player one time. I'd never beaten her. And he actually gave her advice before the match and when we split sets in between the sets. Now, I was going to pull a Boris Becker and die for every ball. I was going to win that match no matter what, and I did. And that was right before I won Portland. So it was the kind of the spark, the impetus, where things really started to go in an upward trajectory. The point to that story is it's sometimes you have no idea what it is that, you know, that extra drive, that extra push that I possibly needed during those few months, those couple of years.
Is it possible it was deliberate that coach wanted to get you angry?
I don't think so. But, you know, whatever it is, at the time I was furious that somebody else was getting so much, you know, free time on the court. But now I'm very thankful.
And so Portland, you're 14 years old, a month after your 14th birthday, and you win a professional tournament. You're not even professional. What was that like?
Portland happened by accident. That winter in Los Angeles, there was a ton of rain. We have no indoor courts, so there wasn't a lot of practice going on. My brother, Jeff, who was a pro, but 11 years older than I was going up to a tournament up in Portland, Oregon, and said, you know what? There's a ladies division. Why don't you come up with me? I stay with this family, the Collins. You can come up and stay with me. You can play in pre-qualifying. I'll take care of you until you lose, and then we'll send you home. So I went up there, went through pre-qualifying, went through qualifying. I kept winning. Jeff finally called my mom and said, you know what? I've lost. I got to go. You know, you got to come up here. And my mom said she was working. And she said, just stay one more match. I'm sure, I didn't know this was happening. I'm sure she's going to lose the next round. Long story short, in between my second round and quarters, where I was going to have to play Mary Carrillo, I actually went back and went to school for a day or two. Flew back up, beat Mary Carrillo in the quarterfinals, and then beat Stacey Margolin in the finals, which allowed me to bump up and play two Virginia Slims level tournaments, which was the main level. At that time, it was easier, I guess, quicker, if you won the title, to be able to bump up to the WTA level. So one and done, I was through the futures and onto the WTA level, not really having anybody know. There was no social media, and I liked it that way. I liked that it was authentic and it wasn't planned.
And every match that you played then, was it just a puzzle to be solved, or were you aware of mounting pressure, whatever form that would have taken?
Yeah. You know, when you say the word pressure, why would there be pressure on 14? You know, every match that I win is just such a bonus. I'm playing people that are 3 to 15 years older than I am.
Until you start winning, and then
yes,
suddenly there is pressure because
yes,
you're the one they want to beat.
Yes, but at that time, it's all a bonus. I've been playing juniors. I hadn't played senior level at all, the WTA level. So, you know, I look back, and I don't know how I found that confidence to just think I could beat these older ladies, but I wasn't thinking outside the box of what this is going to mean or where does this take me. It was just that day I needed to beat that player. This is their game style. What do I need to do to try to win that match?
You see, you don't know how you found the confidence, but now looking back, do you know where that confidence did come from?
Well, I'm saying I don't know where I found it to play that level because I hadn't done it before, but in juniors, I was always, you know, kind of number one in the 12s, number one in the 14s, and building up. So I was used to being a target. I think that was actually very healthy, and it helped me to make the transition with, as you said, the pressure, because almost every tournament that I played, I was, quote, supposed to win. And if you're thinking of it that way, if you're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to win, and you almost think of bracing yourself, that's not the mentality that you can have. That's not the way that you can play with freedom, that you can think with clarity. You have to go in and just compete that match, give the best that you can, fight, grind, use grit, figure out a way to get the W that day. Sometimes it's not going to be pretty, but you're giving your best with each day.
How many players at that stage played with the two-handed backhand in the women's tour?
Almost everybody.
Really?
Yeah.
It had come that quickly.
Oh, yeah, because Chris is 8 years older than I am, so she was 22. Chrissy broke onto the scene at 15, so at that stage, I think most people, the difference also is I think people started playing tennis much younger, and so therefore they started with the two hands and just kept it and realized that there were top players that were succeeding at it, so there was no need to change. If you wanted to, you could.
The International Tennis Hall of Fame's collection is vast, spanning over 25,000 artifacts and millions of images. However, only a fraction of it is on display in the museum in Newport, Rhode Island. But the team at the Hall of Fame has been diligently digitizing its vast collection, so no matter where in the world you are, you can explore some of tennis's greatest history. The International Tennis Hall of Fame has produced exhibits on fashion, rackets, tennis balls, cans, and more. And none of it requires you to leave the comfort of your home. You can explore the award-winning digital exhibits at tennisfame.com/digital-exhibits. Each year, the International Tennis Hall of Fame bestows the ultimate honor in tennis to those who have set themselves apart, both on and off the court. The 260 individuals in the Hall of Fame hail from 27 countries and are enshrined in the museum at the Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. In addition to the legacies of the Hall of Famers on display, from Dick Sears to Andre Agassi to Chrissy Evert and more, the museum boasts a stunning collection of tennis history that is open daily. Plan your trip to the International Tennis Hall of Fame at tennisfame.com/visit. Let's send you back now to Chris Bowers for more of his conversation with Hall of Famer Tracy Austin.
So you won Portland early in 77, and then by June, you're on the centre court at Wimbledon, but dressed in this little Alice in Wonderland dress with a little pocket for the tennis ball in the front.
I was at Wimbledon 4'11". I was 89 pounds. I had braces. I had pigtails. There were not a lot of dress lines available to wear. There wasn't Junior Nike, Junior Adidas. There was very few outfits to wear for somebody that was so tiny. I mean, these were dresses that I started wearing when I was probably 12 years old because I was playing a tournament in Savannah, Georgia. And a young lady that was playing the event was named Lori Costin. Her mom, Marilyn Costin, started a company out of Memphis, Tennessee, called Little Miss Tennis, that had these adorable, age-appropriate dresses that were cotton, that were loose, they were breathable, they had a sash in the back, so it wasn't so tight and restrictive. And the bonus was that there was a pocket for the ball, which you needed for the second ball. So Marilyn came up to my mom at the Savannah Nationals in the summer and said, can I send Tracy a few dresses? So I've been wearing them for a couple of years because they're great dresses. So there was just no other purpose in that they were, I thought, very adorable and age appropriate and very comfortable.
Were you aware of the way your story was presented at Wimbledon?
I was aware because if I was an outsider looking at this little tiny pipsqueak of a girl beating Ellie Vessies from the Netherlands in my first Wimbledon match, she was 6 feet tall. She was a serve and volleyer. She was strong. She was, I don't know what, mid-20s. And I beat her. I'm sure people were perplexed. How does this little tiny girl, win these matches? How is she so focused? How is she so, concentrated for such extended periods of time? How does she find the confidence to beat these players that weigh double the amount that she does? And then it all blew up when I played Chrissy on center court as a 14-year-old, and you're playing best player in the world. She's dating Burt Reynolds. I'm, teeny tiny. And I think it captured the imagination of, funny enough, not only England, but I think of the world, because it was such a different dynamic. It was a intriguing story.
And how did it feel from your angle, or was it just a tennis match to play?
Well, there's different levels. There's the emotional level as far as dealing with the press, because the British press can be kind and they can be very rough. They're dissecting my appearance, they're dissecting my game, which that's fine, I don't care about that. But a 14-year-old to have their appearance dissected and what they're wearing and how I'm wearing my hair, that was more difficult. So you just tried not to pay attention.
That must be the scary bit.
Well, it was actually scary physically sometimes, because going from the locker room to the tea room, people would just surround me. And I remember pens going in my back and, feeling claustrophobic because people wanted autographs, and waiting outside the Wimbledon gates. At that time, the Wimbledon gates didn't open until 12. And I remember my mom asking, they were pushing me against the gate. They wanted my autograph. They wanted this. They wanted that, which was all great. It was all wonderful, but it can become scary. And my mom said, can she just wait on the other side of the gate? She won't go in. Can she just be safe? And they said, no, it's not 12 o'clock yet. So it was a lot to take in for a 14-year-old. But on the incredible side, are you kidding me? I'm in the waiting room with Chrissy before the match, asking her to teach me how to do the curtsy. I'm playing against someone on center court, something that you dream of, somebody that you had been a ball girl for Chrissy. So yeah, it was all unfolding from Portland to when I played Wimbledon. We're talking 6 months. That was a rapid elevation of life-changing weeks, months, whatever it was. But it was wonderful. And I think because my mom really had just her feet on the ground, she was just such a solid, happy lady with five kids, and she did a really good job. I think that really helped to have that good, solid foundation.
That's probably answered the next question, at least in part, because I was going to ask you whether anybody, whether from your family or friends, or I didn't have agents in those days,
No, there were agents.
whether I, okay,
Yeah.
did anyone? Okay.
They were calling, and they laugh at it now, because they'd come over and I'd meet them for 5 minutes, and I'd say, I got to go do my Spanish homework. And I just really wasn't interested in any of that.
I was going to say, did anybody prepare you emotionally for this onslaught? Because even then, in 77, dealing with the British media was an onslaught.
Yeah, I don't think we were prepared for that because it was like a tidal wave, the British media, because coming from a tournament in, I think it was Scotland that I played first, where we came on the train, and the media that was there when I got off the train was incredible. There were so many, and they wanted answers, and they wanted it now, and they had microphones in my face for a 14-year-old, totally unprepared for that. No idea. Then we get on the train, and we're going to take a taxi.
How did you handle it?
You just did the best you could. You know, now, obviously, I'd be able to handle it much better, but at the time, I'm sure I probably said three words, and they thought, oh, wow, she's very shy, which I was. So yes, it was a lot to take in, but again, I think we learned very quickly who to trust, who not to trust, kept a solid kind of insular team in who was on your side.
Because 2 months later, you had a phenomenal run at the US Open. I mean, how much had you grown from that Wimbledon experience to be able to be the player you were at? It was still Forest Hills, wasn't it? It was the
It
last year at
was.
Forest
It
Hills.
was. Yeah, just you saying that's quite incredible now looking back how fast it happened. I never really thought about it that way. But in January, you go to Portland, never having played a professional tournament. And then 9 months later, you're a 14-year-old into the quarterfinals. Yeah, that was a pretty rapid rise.
Beating some good people.
And that was beating Sue Barker. So that was a lot to take in, a lot to learn. But again, I think at the end of the day, every day I was just doing the best that I could with what I had that day, trying to manage my time, still in school. So therefore, it was up to my mom to really be the buffer between, okay, how much is too much? How much do I need to deflect? How much can she take in on this particular day?
When you lost to Chrissie Evert on the centre court at Wimbledon, it was pretty emphatic, but that was absolutely in line with where you were.
Yeah.
2 years later, you were beating her, not just at
One year
Wimbledon.
later.
You beat her a year later, that's right. But I was thinking actually of Wimbledon and the US Open in 79,
Right.
when you ended up on the Grand Slam Roll of Honour at the age of less than 17 still. What do you remember about that run to the Wimbledon semi-finals and the US Open title?
Wow, there's so much in between. So if I can take 2 minutes,
No,
just 2 minutes.
please do.
Yeah, so you're now establishing yourself as a player that, maybe can go deep in slams or push certain players. At 14, I clearly wasn't going to be pushing Martina and Chris because I was not strong enough physically. But by the next year, physically, at 15, I had grown a lot. And that's the first time I beat Martina was at Moody Coliseum in Dallas. I beat her actually 7-6 in the third, 5-4 in the tiebreak. We were still playing that type of tiebreak. And then I beat Chrissy for the first time at Madison Square Garden in the Avon or Virginia Slims Championships. I think I beat her 6-3, 6-1 for the first time. That's my recollection. I could be off a little bit.
And was the physical development just growth, or were you doing more physical work as well?
It was mainly growth, and with that extra 5 inches, with that extra maturity of just going from a little girl to now a young woman. Just the strength was there. That's when I did start to spend more time in the gym. It wasn't just tennis court time, and that all the combination of the above, more time on the tour. So the reason why I think that's important is because the levels in tennis are so important to succeed at each level so that you feel confident. Then some players are out of your reach to beat, but then you keep moving up. And I think that's why when I got to the US Open, when I was 16, it wasn't like it came out of nowhere. I was already top three or four in the world. I had beaten them before. So therefore, when I played Martina in the semis, I knew if I played well that I could win that match. We think of Emma Raducanu. She won 10 matches from qualifying, ranked 150, never having beaten a top 10 player. So therefore, she ramped through and just ripped through about 25 levels. So between 14, 15, and the early stages of when I was 16, whether it was a month or whether it was 2 months, I was gently moving up the ladder. And I think that helped prepare me to win the US Open at such a young age.
And yet 16 is still very young. I mean, we were staggered when Hingis won at 16. We were staggered when Sellers won at 16. I suppose because Pam Shriver had got to the US Open final at 15. The year before. Andrea Jaeger was on the scene. I mean, teenage female players didn't seem as rare then as they do now.
It's interesting because I don't really know what people were thinking going into that, because we didn't have social media like we do now. And we didn't have a lot of talk about, when I started getting the semis and the finals, if you win, you're going to be the youngest ever to win the US Open. I never even had a thought about that. That day when after I had beaten Martina, it was all about, okay, how do I prepare for beating Chris? Because she's the opponent next. It wasn't even about winning the US Open or being the youngest or anything that would come along with it. It was just, she was in the way of winning the title, and that's what I needed to focus on. And I think that's much healthier, because if you start to think of all of the external pressure and you start to think of all the macro, you know, situation, it becomes overwhelming. So if you can just keep it micro to just winning the match, you're able to really focus and be more clear with thought.
Can you put your finger on anything that made the difference between you being able to beat them? Let's leave age out of it for a second. Just being able to beat them at the US Open in 79 when you hadn't been able to beat them at the big tournaments beforehand? Or was it just a question of two players turning up for a tennis match and one was going to win and one was going to lose?
I think beating Chris in the 79 Italian Open in the semifinals, it was in May, where Chris had not lost a match on clay in 6.5 years. That's insane. That's absolutely ridiculous. She had a string of 125 consecutive matches, won on clay. And I beat Chrissy 7-6 in the third that day. And you think I would have won the tournament by then. But no, I still had to play a final against Sylvia Honecke. So I won that, thankfully. But I think that big win really helped me, you know, just a notch or two. So when I got to the U.S. Open, the belief was there. 16 at Wimbledon, I got to the semifinals, lost to, I believe it was Martina. So I was starting to make inroads at majors. I had been to the quarters a couple of times at the U.S. Open, 14, and then again at 15. So it wasn't out of nowhere. I think that's all of those. I keep talking about the little levels that you move up. They don't look big, but you start to add them up, and it really helps you to build a foundation and a platform to have that confidence. So with Chrissy, you said, what was the difference?
Yes.
So I think there's a few things that, first, the mentality, the belief that I could win that match, and then the strength. Now I'm 16, you know, even stronger than when I was 15, so I'm now hitting the ball harder. And I think that really was the difference. And that summer, I had worked with my brother all summer long. He'd come out at 5 o'clock at the end of the day after he was in law school, and we'd hit for a couple of hours just doing drills. And a lot of it was backhand down the line oriented.
Which brother?
Jeff.
Yeah.
Because Chrissy and I could hit this cross court pattern forever. And I felt the need to be able to crack it open with the backhand down the line. And that one shot, I think, set me apart in that match, that I was able to just nail it down the line to change the direction of the ball and have confidence that I could do that.
So you practiced the down-the-line backhand, imagining answering Chrissy's cross-court?
Absolutely. That was a shot that I needed, just the same that I practiced him hitting approach shots with the slice and trying to pass him right away. So those were a couple of things we did over and over and over every day that we played, so that I had certain shots that would be improved for playing Martina, practicing the lob for Martina, practicing return after return after return, and then certain patterns to play against Chrissy to try to open up the court, because our games were like a mirror image of each other. So we could get into this pattern where you'd have 30, 40 shot rallies and it wouldn't be out of the ordinary. So there was some way that I needed, whether it was a sharper angle or was changing the direction of the ball down the line, that I needed to become more proficient at.
Let's go to 81 for a second, where you won your second Grand Slam title at the US Open. It was the first one to be decided on a tiebreak. What do you remember about the tournament and in particular the final?
Before the final, I remember, well, I could go through a lot. Actually, I couldn't even tell you who I beat in each round. Some players can remember the score and who they beat. I think I beat Barbara Potter in the semifinals. But the importance of the finals was huge because that month, that year, I'd already been out for 5 months with a bad back. So I was on the comeback trail. People were already saying, you know, she's not strong enough coming back. She hasn't been back long enough on the comeback. Prior to us going out to play the final was a men's semifinal. I believe it was McEnroe and Gerlaitis. And looked like McEnroe was going to win. And then Vitas came back and won a set. So you're stretching, you're getting ready, you're nervous, feel like you're sapped, you know, your energy is being sapped because you're waiting to play this Grand Slam final and you're on edge. So we go out finally after a long, long wait. It's super windy. Like, besides Eastbourne, probably the windiest match that I've ever played, which is tough to play under any circumstances. But when you're playing a Grand Slam final in those tough conditions, added nerves, it was really difficult. Martina wins the first set 6-1. So I have an opportunity to just kind of disappear, lose quickly, be upset. But I stayed really calm. That's my sense, and that's my demeanor on court. Martina was looking up at the umpire, complaining about the line calls, complaining about the wind. And I'm thinking, wow, she's got six and I've got one. So thankfully, Martina wasn't the same Martina then that she became at the end of her career, where she was so much more focused. Came back to win, as you said, 7-6, 7-6, and really played a match where if I played that now, I'd be thinking, oh my gosh, I'm playing a tiebreak for all the marbles, for a Grand Slam on the title, I'd be a nervous wreck. Somehow I was able to just think about the next point and not, again, think of the outcome. It's just, you know, it's the journey, not the destination. So I think maybe because I was young, maybe because I was naive, whatever it was, I was able to stay in the moment. And as you know, as an athlete, that's really what's so important.
One of the abiding images of that final is where the camera caught Martina just after you'd sat down after the final handshake. Mm-hmm. You'd won the tiebreak 7-1, and she burst into tears. Mm-hmm. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I was. I think there were so many things going on in that final, the undercurrent of what was happening in both of our lives. In her life, she had become a citizen, defected maybe a few years before, never felt accepted. She hadn't won the U.S. Open before. I think maybe she had been outed at some point, so that was a very difficult time for her. So when the U.S. crowd accepted her, when they clapped for her, you know, because she was now an American citizen, she was playing under the American flag, she just let it all out. And I was very aware of it. I think we had all seen Martina win so much, be dominant in score lines, be dominant with her physicality, you know, just look stronger than the rest of us. That sometimes I think the public were not aware of how Martina can be soft. And Martina is, you know, such a feeling and a warm person. She let that be known, and I think they embraced her. So that was wonderful. For me, I didn't take it personally. I think it was just an embrace for someone that really opened up their soul and let the American public and the people that were there, you know, kind of in on her world and what she was feeling at the moment.
Just go back 1 year to the Wimbledon mixed doubles of 1980. I remember the celebration at the end. It struck me as almost more joyous than your two singles titles. I'm sure it wasn't in terms of satisfaction. But what was there about winning with your brother? You're the only brother-sister combination ever to have won the Wimbledon mixed.
I think doubles is so completely different because you're sharing that celebration with somebody. When I won the U.S. Open, there's nobody to jump into their arms, right? So that was just the natural reaction to turn around, drop our rackets, and jump up into my brother, who's 6'3", into his arms, because that was something that we didn't even have the ability to think of, to dream of. You know, when I was a little girl, I may have dreamed of winning a major in singles or dreamed of being number one in the world. It wasn't even on our minds that we could win Wimbledon. That's just insane for us two, John and Tracy, to be able to win the Wimbledon mixed doubles together and the way that we had done it, the path. The year before we had played, we had lost early. And I said, John, that wasn't fun. You know, the man slamming balls at me. I don't want to do that again. He said, let's just do it one more year. And every match that we played, we barely got through. We beat Yvonne Goolagong and John Newcomb. We beat Virginia Wade and BJ Armitage. We beat Betty Stova and Frew McMillan, who are incredible doubles players. So every night we'd go back, have dinner with the family, and it was just joyous. It was fun. Doubles is, I don't want to say more relaxing, but it's almost not quite as intense because you have somebody to share the pressure with. So when we won, we were just over the moon because it was not expected, and we had saved a match point.
And is that almost a greater family celebration?
Yes, absolutely. To have your mom, your dad, I think one of our, I can't remember who else was there, but a couple other family members were there. To be able to go back each night and celebrate. Oh, you remember this point? Oh, yeah, that happened. And then we've held our serve. We broke serve there. To be able to share that together is, you know, is beautiful because, as I said, an individual sport, you don't really get that teamwork.
You mentioned that you missed 5 months of 81 with a back problem. Mm. I mean, tennis players have all sorts of problems. But in retrospect, that was probably a sign of growing rebellion by your body. Were you aware that it might be a long-term issue at the time?
No, totally not. So when I came back, I was out for those 5 months, and then I won the U.S. Open. So then I'm thinking, okay, I'm back on track. And the same back problem cropped up in 82, and I was out for another bunch of months. And then coming back, it was then that I started to struggle with, you know, one injury after another. And I think if I had been born 10, 20 years later with the physios that travel with each individual player, the trainers that are with each individual on a team, part of their entourage, really dealing with injuries as they crop up, dealing with recovery, stretching better. The players just take so much better care of their body now, and that's why they're able to, because of the knowledge, because they have firsthand people on their team that are right there, right then, to kind of fix things. That's why they're able to play into their mid-30s, early 40s today. So that's where the problems started to rise, is because the back came back again, and then it was just kind of this trickle-down.
Very sciatica, nerve problems.
Yes. Yeah.
There was a lot of talk at that time about teenage burnout, but that was very much talk of mental burnout. To what extent might you have been the victim of physical burnout?
Yeah, you know, I don't know the answer to that, because I can only attest to the fact that I did everything that I could to come back. I think if I was 5'9", it probably would have been better. I'm 5'5", you know, slightly built. I don't think that helped playing all of those hours, and all of those hours are what I needed in order to get the groove, to get the rhythm, to get the training that I needed to get to the top. So yeah, and actually that was very hurtful when people, here you are injured, doing everything you think you can to try to come back and play, because that's what your dreams are, and people are making comments. That was a time that was very difficult. Even famous tennis players that I'm not going to go into, I still remember what they would say. And they would surmise this, or they guess about that.
Linking emotional burnout to the physical problems you were having?
Correct, yeah.
And what hurt you about that? The fact that...
Because they had no idea. They had no idea. You know, if you are a tennis player yourself, call me up and say, hey, how can I help you? You know, what are you going through? Instead, they have no idea, and they're spouting off, and they're famous people. So I thought that was really hurtful.
In retrospect, your best years were the early years. I mean, so much of what you did was very, very young. Do you feel good about that, in the sense that there's been a lot more life to have, or do you feel very sad that there was not more of your career at the top?
Oh, I think both. I think the predominant feeling is that I wish my career had been 10 more years. I wish that, I always thought that I would play at least till, at that time, we didn't play into our mid-30s, but at least till 27, 30 years old. I was hopeful to play that long, and, you know, winning, I don't know how many titles I won, but at a very young age, you're thinking you're just going to keep on with that lifestyle, traveling around, playing, you know, the four majors, other tournaments, and it's going to be another decade of that. So that was a very difficult time to have it all suddenly shut down. So without a doubt, every athlete wants to retire on their own terms. And I didn't get to have that. Looking back, I think I'm a pretty well-rounded person because of that, maybe. You know, and maybe I would have been anyway. But I am a type of a person. I eventually was in a car accident when I was 25. And I think that changed my perspective. You know, a guy hit me at 65 miles an hour in my front left wheel well. So half a second more, he would have hit my door and I wouldn't be here. So that's where you kind of realize, like, there's bigger things than tennis. And I think I either truly believe that or I trick myself into believing that, because if I start to dig into what could have been if I played 10 more years, that's not comfortable. And the 10 years that I had not playing, I built a wonderful family that I have. So I think everybody has regrets or disappointments, I guess I should say, because I did the best that I could. But we all move forward with new perspective that we've gathered.
Do you feel you had the recognition that you deserved?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in what way?
Well, my mind goes back to, this is a strange example, but the playwright Willie Russell, when he wrote Educating Rita, which was later a very successful film, he gave the young Rita a line, "Some people can't tell the difference between Jane Austen and Tracy Austen," which was a remarkable reflection of the fact that you had transcended tennis. People were using your name in a very mainstream play about education. Does that give you a sense of, I really am a world personality, or does that not matter to you?
Something that I don't think about, to tell you the truth. It just is. It is what it is. You know, I think, you know, you're on the cover of Sports Illustrated at 13, you know, again at 16, getting to world number one, having the injuries and then going into television. So I've had really two complete careers that I feel like I've had success in. So I'm appreciative of that. So yeah, I feel like I've gotten the recognition. You know, I do sometimes think the rivalry that was Chrissy and Martina might have been different because I was right in the mix of it. I was, you know, I have a winning record against Chrissy, don't have a winning record against Martina, but beat her plenty of times. So there are times when I think about that, you know, what would have been, what could have been if it was three of us instead of just the two, because they both won 18, you know, they had played 80 times, and I'm 8 years younger than Chrissy. So I definitely had to retire way too young.
You obviously got the recognition of being inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
I think it means so much to every individual. And I don't think at the beginning of the career, it's something that you think of. You, as a little girl, you think maybe, oh, I'd like to win a major. That would really be a huge goal of mine. I'd like to be number one in the world. But there isn't that thought of Hall of Fame. It's not really talked about. When you're playing, you're concerned about the next tournament. You're concerned about your schedule leading up to a major. How can you apply yourself, get ready for that tournament the best way that you can? So when the Hall of Fame comes at you and it's an affirmation that you've had a successful career, that you had wonderful achievements in the craft that you love so much, that you've dedicated your life to, it's really the ultimate compliment.
It came very early. And you were still actually thinking of a comeback, I think, after you had a small comeback after.
Yes, after the car accident.
Do you feel that's a little bittersweet? You made a beautiful speech at your induction. It seemed well beyond your 29 years. But was that because the honour of being inducted superseded the fact that it happened early? Or is that also a little bit a source of sadness?
I think it's both. I think you're extremely proud that you're inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and to be in amongst with the Rod Lavers and the Maureen Conleys and on and on and on. You know, that's a pinch me moment, and it's you're very appreciative. But yes, there is a tinge every time they say, I think they think it's a compliment when they say the youngest inductee into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. But what that means is that you retired young. So it's both.
What do you feel is your greatest achievement in tennis?
Greatest achievement in tennis? I don't know. I think, you know, at the end of the day, as a player, you want to try to win a major. You want to try to be number one. You want to try to win Fed Cup for your country, which is now called the Billie Jean King Cup. I was able to win three of those, which was so special to play for your country. There's nothing like it when you're ready to compete and you're playing against another team and they're playing the national anthem and you've got, you know, flags on your pocket of the dress that Ted Tinley made for you. And it says USA on the back of your jacket instead of Austin. That's, again, a pinch me moment that you're playing for much more than yourself now. Tennis is an individual sport. We've talked about that theme, but now you're representing your country. So that was special. You know, I think just being able to compete with Chrissy and Martina in a special era, maximizing, I think, my potential. I mean, there are days, there's many days where I look back at the Jack Cramer Club and I think of all of those young ladies and young men. Actually, Pete Sampras came out of there, Lindsay Davenport. But there were so many, there were hundreds that wanted to do that. What I did. And there must have been something that I did right. I don't know what the recipe is. Actually, there is no one magical recipe, but there's a lot of boxes that you need to check. I feel really, really lucky and very appreciative that I had the career. Would it have been better if it was longer? Yes. But did I probably exceed, you know, when I was seven, did I think I was going to do all that? I don't think so.
And now you're a tennis mom.
Yes, I am.
Brandon is trying to make his way on the ATP tour. How has your own experience shaped you as a mother of a tennis player?
Boy, have I learned a lot. Boy, do I appreciate my mom as a tennis mom. She was so even keeled, always so positive, but yet analytical. You know, she felt that it was important at a certain time, not within the first hour, because who wants to hear anything about a loss then? But at some point, the discussion would be opened up because that's how you learn and hopefully improve for the next time. But I've learned a lot as a tennis mom, when to talk, when to back off. Three boys that all played tennis, all wanted to take it to a different level. Some wanted a little more advice. Some wanted me to really back off. So I think that's something that eventually I'm very proud of, the way that I was able to kind of maneuver being a tennis mom. They all find joy with tennis. And it wasn't about me. And that's where it was really fascinating to watch, because as a kid, I wanted it. It was me driving the train. But going to all these junior tournaments with Brandon, there were so many parents that were driving the train. And the kid was feeling, I felt like they were being dragged along. And it wasn't necessarily what they wanted to do. It was clearly the parents' desire and the parents' dream. And that kid was going to play tennis, whether they liked it or not. And the dynamic, the relationship between them, just to see all the different, you know, elements. Sometimes I wanted to pull a parent aside and say, you know what, there's so much more after this tennis that you guys are going to be spending another 50 years together. Make sure that you keep your relationship intact, because so many of the relationships were unhealthy.
So does this happen when you're coaching youngsters? Do you find yourself talking as much to the parents as to the kids?
Yeah, I don't coach many youngsters, but yeah, I did with the USTA for a little bit, but it's more just watching during those tournaments. And I write a lot in Tennis Magazine about maybe some ideas for parents, because I think as a former player who really didn't feel the need to have my kids be great at tennis, only if it was their dream, you know, it wasn't going to be my dream. I was able to step back and kind of understand more of how to handle that situation. I believe, again, it's so important that they think macro. This tennis player, micro. Tennis parent, macro. You know, where are we going with this journey? And is it my dream or is it their dream? And am I listening? Am I listening to my kid enough? And that's so important.
You should do some workshops on these, shouldn't you?
I would love to. I really would.
You and have not, authority.
Yeah, not for any other reason that there are so many kids I want to pull aside and say, you know what? You were wonderful today. You gave your all. You didn't win, but that's okay. That's all you can give on this particular day. And then you see them going with their parent and their parents not happy about the situation. Now, I do want to say that's not all tennis parents, but there's enough that I'm a mom with a big heart that even if I see a few, it's really hard to watch. So those are the few that you want to take aside and say, oh, you know, let's try to work on this.
Tracy Austin, thank you so much for sharing your career in tennis.
Thank you.
Wow. What a conversation. A big thank you to my friend and colleague Tracy Austin for joining us on the Tennis Worthy podcast. If you like what you heard today, please share this show with somebody who's interested in, well, a lot of things. A winning mindset, being a team phenom, what it's like to set foot on center court at Wimbledon for the first time, or raising an elite athlete. The greatest compliment you can give us is to share this show with those you care about. The Tennis Worthy podcast was created by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.